Tax season has arrived, and doing taxes without the right help can feel overwhelming. Intuit TurboTax is here now to guide you through it with confidence. Match with a TurboTax full-service expert who handles everything for you from start to finish. Your dedicated expert checks every single deduction and credit to help you get the best possible outcome so you can feel confident you're getting every dollar you deserve. And the best part? You'll see real-time updates on your expert's progress right on your phone while you live your life. Plus, you get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Full Service Experts. Real-time updates only on iOS mobile app.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This week in our season where we are highlighting justice warriors, I have a whole crew here with me, and they're from real close to home. I thought as we were starting our recording here, I could have just went down there and sat in the office with you guys. Their office is about 10 minutes away from my house. I have three people from the Exoneration Justice Clinic at the University of Notre Dame. I'll go through real quickly and just kind of introduce the three people that are here. So we have the founder and executive director, Professor Jimmy Grulet, is here. I have one of the staff lawyers who helps teach some of the classes at the university, Kevin Murphy. And then one of what the Innocence Project of Texas they call student attorneys, Andrew, made clear he's just about ready to go take that bar exam. He's not an attorney yet. So attorney in training, Andrew Zimlick. And Andrew worked specifically on the case that got my attention. And that was the exoneration of a man named Reginald Dillard out of Elkhart, Indiana, also just right down the road from me. It was actually our co-host, Zach Weaver, that saw the story and sent it over to me. I reached out. We had a conversation last week about the case. And so we're just going to kind of see where the conversation goes. We're going to walk through. I think Kevin and Andrew will spend some time talking about Reggie's case individually or in particularly. And then we'll kind of move on to Professor Grulet, who will talk about what they're doing over there as a whole at the Exoneration Justice Clinic. So first of all, gentlemen, all three of you, thank you guys so much for joining me.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks,
my
Bob.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us, Bob.
Yeah, and you guys have done some great work, and we got so much ground to cover, so we'll get right into the case first. Kevin, you were the staff attorney, and you were one of the attorneys. There were several. Sounds like there's a whole team of attorneys that work with you guys. But you said you just recently represented Mr. Dillard at his evidentiary hearing that led to his exoneration. So between you and Andrew, whoever wants to do it, if you guys could, first and foremost, you know, tell us about this case that just got overturned.
I'm happy to take a first stab at this. And Andrew, you can tell me what I'm missing. The gist, back in the late 90s, an informant in Elkhart by the name of Christopher Thomas was shot and killed outside of the Three Points Motel where he was living. In Elkhart. At the time, a couple eyewitnesses said that they saw two men who were wearing dark clothing fleeing the crime scene shortly after the shooting. From there, the case was essentially cold for several months till an Elkhart detective by the name of Stephen Rizzuto, and we'll come back to him and talk more about him, I'm sure, at points throughout this interview. He was able to develop a woman by the name of Tricia Mock as a supposed eyewitness to this murder. Other witnesses, you know, didn't place her there, didn't place a woman there at all. And Miss Mock was a prostitute in the Elkhart community who had been arrested and was being kept at the Elkhart County Jail. And in essence, Detective Rizzuto went and talked to her, you know, one-on-one a couple times and took, I think, a series of different statements from her. She initially told him she didn't know anything about this murder, but then he goes and talks to her further. And all of a sudden she claims, oh, no, actually, I saw These guys by the name of Eddie Frederick and Reggie Dillard reenact this murder after it had happened. And then he goes back and talks to her again, and she claims, oh no, I was there when this murder happened, and they used me to get in the door of Christopher Thomas's room where they essentially shot and killed him as he was walking out of his room. And that's the story, and that is the only factual basis at the time for charging Reggie Dillard and Eddie Fredericks. There was no physical evidence that linked them in any way to the crime. There was no DNA. There was no fingerprints. There were no eyewitnesses who said, yes, these are the men that we saw that night. And the eyewitnesses, in fact, said that there wasn't, or they didn't see a woman present at the time of this murder. But that was enough to get Reggie and Eddie Frederick charged in 1999. And from 1999 until just last month, Reggie Dillard was incarcerated for this murder that he was ultimately convicted of in January of 2000. There's lots more to that story that happened in between 1999 and 2026. But one of the things is that Eddie Frederick, his co-defendant, died in prison. Reggie had a stroke while he was in prison. He lost a lot of his family members. He lost a ton of his life. Over 26 years that he spent incarcerated, actually, I believe it was just over 27 years that he was incarcerated for. And ultimately, his conviction was vacated and the state dismissed the case against him based on new evidence that pointed to other men being involved in this murder. And that was just some of the evidence that we presented at 3-day evidentiary hearing for Mr. Dillard in February.
Did the prosecution join a motion, or were they fighting it until the end and the judge overturned it?
Ultimately, the prosecution at the close of the evidentiary hearing, and I think this was really unique, they agreed that Reggie's conviction should be vacated. And so we went into court after the evidence had come in and told the judge that the parties both agreed that Mr. Dillard's rights under a case called Brady v. Maryland had been violated. And the gist of what that case says is that the state has an obligation to turn over to criminal defendants and their attorneys material exculpatory information. Here in this case, the big piece of information that was never given to Reggie or his attorneys was that the very day after Reggie and Eddie were wrongfully convicted, a woman called the police department and provided them with information in a stunning level of detail about how it wasn't actually Reggie and Eddie who had done this murder. It was her partner and his brother. And she laid out how these men had a motive to kill Christopher Thomas. They knew that they had learned that he was an informant against them in their drug cases. And she laid out how her partner was dressed in all dark clothing, left the house that night, and he had made a comment about how Christopher Thomas had to be dealt with. And then he came back that night and she saw a bunch of cartridge cases from bullets that had been fired in the toilet. And at that point in time, her partner sees her, basically discovering this evidence of a murder, and threatens her life and says if she ever tells anyone, he's going to kill her, and actually forces her to help him dispose of both those cartridge cases and the murder weapon that was used to kill Christopher Thomas. So when you think of exculpatory evidence, this is like the ultimate piece of exculpatory evidence. It so clearly showed that someone else had done this murder, and yet this information was received by the Elkhart police, and as best as we can tell, it was never provided to the prosecutors, and it certainly was never provided to Reggie or Eddie or their attorneys. So they went to their sentencing not knowing this information, and then they went to prison for decades never knowing this information that fit, these other men being involved in this murder. And it was frankly more evidence in this one police report than there was, in my opinion, in the entire case against Eddie and Reggie. But it was withheld. It was concealed for them for years and years.
Bob, as Kevin has just stated, there was a ton of material exculpatory evidence that was withheld, never disclosed to the defense in this case. And one of those items involved Detective Stephen Rizzuco, and Kevin has alluded to him. He was a lead investigator in the case. And what we learned during the investigation was that Stephen Rizzuco had been the subject of two police internal affairs investigations involving gross police misconduct, specifically that Steve Rizzuco was having sexual relations with female informants that were working for him, including Tricia Mock. And he was paying them for sex. And again, he was disciplined based upon these internal investigations that were conducted involving these claims and allegations. And ultimately, he was released, really forced out of the police department after the second internal investigation concluded that he continued engaging in this same type of just egregious, you know, police misconduct. And again, that evidence was never disclosed to the defense. And had it been disclosed, it clearly would have undermined the integrity of the entire investigation. And Tricia Mock's testimony that was elicited by Steve Rizzuto after he interviewed her, you know, no less than three times, and where, again, she gave, you know, inconsistent statements regarding her knowledge of the killing and the crime.
Did you guys get a sense of, you know, I see cases like this sometime, and usually there's, sometimes you can find, like, the obvious reason, and sometimes it's just baffling. Did anyone get a sense throughout your investigation as to why, when they kind of basically, it sounds like, had the case handed to them on a silver platter, they ignored that real evidence in order to, what sounds like, fabricate the evidence against a different defendant? Has anything come to light on that, or do you guys have thoughts on that?
Well, let me make a brief comment, and then, of course, I'll let Kevin and Andrew add to it. But what we've seen in many, if not all, of the cases that we've accepted for legal representation and, you know, by the Exoneration Justice Clinic, and it's something called tunnel vision, you know, where the police will zero in on a particular suspect and they reach a conclusion based upon a narrative that they've developed that this person is guilty, he committed the crime. And as a result, any evidence that is discovered that's inconsistent with that narrative, that would be inconsistent with the person that they've concluded committed the crime, you know, some alternative suspect, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it because, again, it's going to undermine their narrative. It's going to undermine the theory that they've developed. And so they look at the case with this tunnel vision and, again, discard, ignore any evidence that contradicts the narrative that they've constructed. And we've seen this occur time and time again and the EJC cases that we've investigated and litigated.
It's just like cognitive dissonance at a horrific level. There was no, like, the guy that actually did it was a buddy or a CI or something like that. It just, he had already set aside on these other two, and so he wasn't accepting any, what I always call it, bad evidence when cops look at what's bad evidence because it doesn't fit their narrative.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't think we ever were able to develop any evidence that there was a specific motive to protect these other individuals. I think it was a case where this was a high-profile murder. They had taken it to, you know, a week-long trial. There'd been a lot of coverage of it because he was a police informant, the victim, that is. And I think that someone made the call, and we don't know who exactly it was, that, you know what, we're just going to disregard this information. We don't want to undo all the hard work of our police department and our prosecutor's office just did to get these guys convicted. So we're going to just sit on this. And it's hard. I mean, obviously, there's no legitimate justification for it. It's hard to even lay it out in the abstract because it's such a miscarriage of justice to just hide that evidence and not even let the defense attorneys, not even give it to them at the time. So I think Professor Grulet is right. It's a classic case of tunnel vision.
When did the call come in with this new information? Was it at trial or after the conviction?
It was the day after they were convicted that
okay.
this information came in. But it was still, you know, months before sentencing or a month before sentencing. And as courts have held, in essence, the Brady obligation that the state has to turn over exculpatory evidence continues until a conviction becomes final. So not only does it continue through that period of sentencing, it also goes until a direct appeal is complete. So there's no question that this was information that Reggie and Eddie and their attorneys were entitled to.
Right. And I guess the thought of their thought process makes a little more sense to me. If they said they already had their conviction, they're like, well, yeah, we already closed it. We don't want to start it over. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Rewards programs are a lot like pop culture. They can be hard to keep up with. But with Venmo's new rewards program, Venmo Stash, rewards are so easy because the more you do, the more you get. And you choose the bundle of brands you get cash back at. It's giving fiscal queen. It's giving star. It's giving up to 5% cash back at your favorite brands. Just pick a bundle of your go-to spots to shop with your Venmo debit card and earn cash back at them. Do more, get more with Venmo Stash. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms.
It's tax season, and by now, I know we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. Here's another one. One in four honest, hardworking, taxpaying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, LifeLock's U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, backed by another good number. The Million Dollar Protection Package. In fact, restoration is guaranteed or your money back. Don't face identity theft and financial losses alone. There's strength in numbers with LifeLock Identity Theft Protection for tax season and beyond. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
I want to shift over to you, Andrew, as a student, because, you know, I've worked in this wrongful conviction space for over 10 years now. Actually getting to walk somebody out of prison is pretty rare. It's less, you know, as you know, less than 1% of these cases end up in, you know, being overturned. And before you take the bar exam, you've got to work on one where you got to walk somebody out of that prison. So first of all, and then I want to talk about the process a little bit. Talk to me about that feeling. What was that like the day that you got to go there and see that the hard work you've done has resulted in saving a man's life?
Yeah, it all happened really quickly. I think that's something that Kevin and I were talking about even at the hearing. It just felt like all of a sudden we felt like things went well to the next moment. The judge was ruling on the spot to grant Reggie relief. And then a few days later, we were having these conversations about him walking out of jail. And it only took 4 days after the actual hearing for us to show up at the Elkhart County Jail and walk him out. So what I remember most about that was just waiting in the lobby. I think mm-hmm. we got there and, you know, it was probably another 30, 40 minutes before Reggie actually walked out. And every time the doors opened, we were just looking through, waiting for him to come. And we kind of just let that be his moment. Obviously 27 years is a long time, longer than I've been alive. And for him to walk out like that and embrace him was, as you said, something that was probably once in a lifetime for me.
Well, hopefully not. You got a long career ahead of you. But yeah, I know that feeling. We had one of our cases down in Texas when it wasn't nearly as fast. Like, we got word he was being released, and it was like months before that finally he got transferred and moved over and finally walked out of prison after 20 years. And yeah, I can relate to the waiting, as can, you know, about 100 of my listeners that were all down there waiting to greet him on the other side, just waiting for him to walk out. Luckily, Ed is 6'7" and bald, so he was easy to spot when he came walking out of the prison. That's amazing. And yeah, I sure hope that that's not your once in a lifetime experience. Hopefully it's the first of many. So talk to me about the process as a student. How long did you work on the case? You're in your final year. You said you're about to wrap up law school. How long did you work on Reggie's case?
You know, Reggie was exonerated last month, February of 2026. And I would have started working on Reggie's case in August of 2024. So, you know, about a year and a half at the start of my second year of law school is really when I came onto the case. And I was fortunate that we already had a 273-page petition for post-conviction relief for Reggie. So that was very helpful to have just as a starting point. But from there, it was a lot of hard work just learning the facts of the case before you can jump in and actually help with the substantive legal part of it.
Did that brief that was already written, did that include the Brady material that ultimately got him released?
It did. Yeah. Fortunately, most of the investigation had been completed by the time I came onto things, but you know, it had taken years and years of work before that.
Let me just add, Bob, that Andrew participated in the evidentiary hearing and examined the police officer that laid the foundation for the admissibility of the police report that, again, that had highlighted that there was this call that came in and this woman had identified her partner and the brother of the partner as the actual killers. So Andrew played a direct role in getting that critical evidence in to the court at the evidentiary hearing.
That's incredible. Is that, Kevin, I'll throw it to you. Is that kind of standard practice with you guys? Because I've worked with several different clinics around the country, but I don't think I've heard of any time where a student actually, especially in such a critical hearing, actually went up and did the direct examination of someone. Is that something you guys typically do? Is that a standout that you trusted Andrew to do that?
I think, in every one of our cases, we try to look for opportunities to give our students, you know, stand-up experience. But I will say, I think, you know, this was unique, and part of that is because we had total confidence in Andrew, his abilities as only a law student. He'd actually worked with us at the clinic even when he was an undergrad at Notre Dame. I think he's our most tenured student ever. Professor Drula, you can correct me if I'm wrong there. But Andrew had earned that opportunity. He had been, you know, the person most in the weeds on the facts and the law on the case for a while. And we did lots of moots with him to get him ready. Professor, you were involved in those too, and lots of prep work with the witness where Andrew and I talked to the police officer who took this report and made sure that, you know, that we weren't going to get anything unexpected. So there was a lot of work that went into it, but ultimately Professor Grulet, you know, gave Andrew that opportunity because we had
We prepped him and we prepped him and we prepped him. We had, I think, about maybe three dry runs, you know, through mooting where we had him go through the questions and then we critiqued him rigorously. Critiqued him. No, that's not quite good enough. Let's go back and we'll do it again tomorrow. We'll go do it again, you know, in a couple of days from now. And then Andrew would go back and revise his questions and come back and you do it again and we grill him again. It's better, but not quite there yet. You know, maybe one more time. And then eventually we got to that point where, like, you got it. And so it was all about preparation, something that I preached to the students and the staff all the time. You know, success in the practice of law depends upon preparation. You've got to be prepared. So we were confident that Andrew was as prepared as anyone for conducting this examination and could respond to any questions, any challenges, any objections that the other side could raise or might raise during the questioning of the police officer.
What an incredible opportunity. And I'm sure with all the preparation, you weren't, pardon my French, shitting your pants at all, Andrew, before you went in open court to go. Was that the first time you questioned someone in open court?
No, it's funny. Actually, about a month prior to that, we had a hearing for another case, and I gave the opening statements for that one, which was a lot less stressful because, you know, it was much more like delivering a speech, reading off a script, whereas, you know, Professor Gorilla hit the nail on the head. I had to be prepared to respond to actual objections from the prosecutor on the other side.
Nice. And when that was all said and done, I think I heard you use the word embrace. Did you get to hug Reggie after he walked out?
I did. Yeah. On the following Monday when he came out.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to get to know him throughout the process, through the year and a half or so you were working on it? Did you talk to him much?
Yeah, I did. Not quite as well as maybe Kevin and Professor, but that's definitely an emphasis, you know, the clinic makes is for the students to have direct interaction with our clients. So I think I visited Reggie in prison twice. I'd been on a few phone calls with him, and that just really makes the experience so much richer for me. Definitely adds that extra layer of motivation to understand that, okay, I'm sitting here late at night doing work, but this is what it's for. I've actually had the chance to walk into the jail facility and see, you know, how a person's life has been taken away. So very grateful to have had that experience.
Yeah, well, we refer to this as proximity. And so we want to ensure that our students have that proximity, that face-to-face interaction with the client, so they can connect with the humanity and the dignity of the person that they're representing. And so we strive mightily to ensure that every student has that personal connection, that personal meeting with the client at least once a semester, if not more often, and if not in person, then by phone and so forth. But it's so critical because, again, it motivates the students. You know, once they have that, because a lot of this work can be drudgery. You know, you're reviewing a 1,000-page trial transcript. You're reviewing hundreds of pages of police reports and forensic reports and witness statements. There's nothing sexy about that. But when you go there and you meet your client in person, all of a sudden, all that drudgery, all that hard work, you know, you realize why you're doing it. And then it ignites the fire, ignites the passion of the students to work even harder to free their innocent client.
Andrew, is your plan after you, I'm sure you're going to pass the bar first try, no problem. When that's done and you become a lawyer, is your intention to work in post-conviction law?
You know, my immediate plans are to go to Chicago and work off my loans for a few years. And then after that, we'll see. You know, this is without a doubt been the most special experience I've had in law school. And it's hard to imagine getting that type of fulfillment out of anything else.
I can tell you our intentions, Bob, and that's to persuade Andrew to get back into this work as soon as he can.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And that's, you know, being a lawyer, becoming a lawyer is such a difficult, it's such a long commitment and it's so much work and so many long nights. What is it that motivates you to, or has motivated you to get into this line of work?
I had an experience a few summers ago when I was still an undergrad. I interned at a public defender's office in my home state of South Carolina. You know, I actually kind of had a case where there were some questions as to, you know, whether a conviction was valid. And I was just shocked by the fact that the public defenders were left with zero resources in comparison to the prosecutors to combat that and correct that. So when I got to Notre Dame, the exoneration clinic was just getting started. And I kept seeing news, I kept hearing about it. And one thing led to another. I worked there my final year of undergrad, and the more and more I learned, I just loved it.
I would just add, you know, Kevin is unique. You know, Kevin was working for a major law firm in Chicago prior to joining the Exoneration Justice Clinic. And he left this really prestigious position with his very prestigious law firm in Chicago to take a substantial cut in pay to come to return to Notre Dame, where he graduated as a law student, and to work as a staff lawyer. And so he made a substantial sacrifice financially for him and his family to undertake this kind of work. And I don't know, Kevin, why did you do that? Why did you make such a sacrifice?
I mean, the day last month with Reggie is the perfect example. You know, getting to be a part of a moment like that is just so special to know that your efforts have led to something, to that kind of moment, to that where someone gets their liberty back. That is what drove me to do it. When I was at Jenner in Chicago, I got asked to join a pro bono case that was a wrongful conviction case. And I was the one like talking to the client all the time and developing a relationship with him. And it was a really, you know, tough case that took years and years that ultimately culminated in us getting him exonerated. And I got to be a part of, as a young associate, walking him out of prison. And I thought to myself, oh man, like, how am I going to go back to doing the other work for the rest of my time after this? It's nothing against securities and commodities litigation, but it's not quite as fun as getting an innocent person out of prison.
It's such a weird area of law. Did you say you worked for Jenner?
Yeah, I did.
Block? I'm working on a case with them right now. Our season we just wrapped up. Yeah.
No kidding. Yeah. They're wonderful attorneys.
They're incredible. But yeah, it's the post-conviction work, like we said, it's such a small percentage. I mean, it's so many L's you take. You work so long and so hard, and it's so hard to get over that Herculean burden to get someone released from prison. But it just seems like when you do and you have that moment, Kevin, obviously, you know, you were there, you were representing Reggie at the hearing. You were there when he walked out. What was that like for you?
It was surreal. I mean, especially when you think these moments might come, you know, if at all, years down the road. And instead, you know, 3 days after the evidentiary hearing, Reggie's walking out and you got to embrace him. And I think, you know, Reggie put it the way that we all were feeling when he, you know, it was a cold day. It was like 20 degrees or something in Elkhart when he walked out the doors of their jail and he said, I'm numb. And I think that was, you know, how everyone was feeling in that moment, was just numb, that this moment's here, this man who has spent decades in prison for something that he didn't do is free. He's free to return to his kids, to his fiance, to his freedom, to the world, you know, after so long. It was just, I was numb. I mean, I think we all were.
It's something that I hope you guys hang on to for the rest of your lives, is that regardless of where you go from here, I just think of any little, you know, regardless of whatever someone's profession is or what their life's goals are. And you guys, both, all three of you guys seem like this is, you know, you desire to make an impact. And I think you should never lose sight of the fact, and those long nights where you're digging through those trial transcripts after five L's in a row, that you literally, you guys, your organization, you as individuals, literally changed lives, not just one. But I mean, and that's incredible. And I got to know, because I need to know if I'm the only one who cried. Who cried at when you got released?
I was definitely crying.
My man, Kevin.
Following up to that,
I would just add, Bob, the Exoneration Justice Clinic embraces something called holistic legal representation. And so what that means is our responsibility to our client doesn't end in the courtroom. So the day that the judge exonerates our client's released from prison, you know, we don't just embrace him. Oh, congratulations, really happy for you. Good luck. You know, after someone has spent 27 years in prison and now is faced and confronted with the difficulty of rebuilding your life, you know, rebuilding, starting your life all over again.
Right.
So we work very closely with our clients in identifying what their needs are, you know, post exoneration, you know, and making that transition, then assisting them, kind of holding their hand, so to speak, through the process, whether it's assistance in finding lodging, finding a place to live, employment, you know, education, medical health care needs, mental health care needs, something from as small as helping them get a driver's license.
Yeah.
To dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder that they've suffered, having served, you know, 27 years in prison, knowing that you're innocent, knowing that you didn't commit the crime. And why then am I here? Why am I, you know, why did the criminal justice system fail me? And so it's a difficult transition. And the EJC continues to work with our clients to assist them in making that reentry back into society.
Rewards programs are a lot like pop culture. They can be hard to keep up with. But with Venmo's new rewards program, Venmo Stash, rewards are so easy because the more you do, the more you get. And you choose the bundle of brands you get cash back at. It's giving fiscal queen. It's giving star. It's giving up to 5% cash back at your favorite brands. Just pick a bundle of your go-to spots to shop with your Venmo debit card and earn cash back at them. Do more, get more with Venmo Stash. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms.
Moto Casino, America. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
That's great. That was one of the questions I had for you is, how's Reggie doing now? And how are you? Because we went through that with Ed, the guy I was just talking about. I actually sat with him at the DMV when he went to get his driver's license. And it was, you don't think about, you know, he was locked up for 20 years, how many hurdles they have to go through. I think it's incredible that you guys are helping him through that process. How's he doing now? It's only been, what, less than a month?
Go ahead, Kevin.
I was going to say, he's, you know, so far so good. I think he's like enjoying the peace and slow pace of his life and being in an environment where, like, I talked to him the other morning and he was outside on his porch just watching birds.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, like, you and I would totally take for granted. But for him, it's like a new life and a new beginning, right? He'll have a lot of challenges ahead of him. You know, I mentioned he had a stroke and he'll still have rehab and he has some blood pressure issues. So there's all sorts of challenges. But I think he's doing a good job right now, taking it day by day. We helped him launch a GoFundMe to cover some of his immediate costs. And I think that's alleviated some of the burden, but, you know, there's lots more work to do. And we totally view it as a team effort to, you know, help him successfully reenter society and pick up, you know, where he left off, or, you know, start a new beginning for him.
That's amazing. And I'll have to make sure one of you guys emails me the link to that GoFundMe, because we'll include that. And my listeners, I'm sure, will be wanting to help. So we'll want to include that in the description of this episode so they can, you know, if they want to donate to that. And that leads me into, I spent the last couple of minutes, Professor Grulet, can you talk about just, we've covered quite a bit of it, but I just want to talk about the Exoneration Justice Clinic in general. You were founder, executive director, you know, when did it come to be, and what kind of work have you guys been doing? What kind of success rate? Anything that you want to share for my listeners to know the good work you guys are doing down there?
Well, it started in 2020. And so we've been in operation now just under 6 years. It was really a student-initiated effort. And the way that it came about was that I would teach first-year criminal law at law school. This was a class that the 1L students, first-year law students, would take. And very often, I would kind of interrupt the assigned readings for the day to discuss exoneration stories that I had learned of the night before watching cable news. And you'd see this picture of the defendant coming out of the courtroom. He's been exonerated. He's reunited with his family. And it's this wonderful, you know, happy picture, joyous moment for the accused and the family. And I looked at it a little differently. And my perspective was, well, I'm really happy, you know, that the justice was done, even though it was 20 years later, 20 years after you spent that time in prison. But, like, how did this happen? You know, why did the system, criminal justice system, break down to permit this injustice to happen? So I'd have that discussion with the students involving a specific case, again, exoneration that occurred the day before. And then the following year, one of the students who was in that class came to me and said, you know, this was very impactful, you know, these exoneration stories that we discussed in class. And I want to start a student organization at Notre Dame Law School to educate the general public about the scope of the problem. And most of the public, they do not understand the scope and the extent of wrongful convictions in this country. Since 1989, there have been approximately 3,800 individuals who were exonerated. Their convictions were overturned, the charges were dismissed based upon actual innocence. And over 200 of those exonerations involved individuals who were on death row. They were going to be executed by the state for a crime they didn't commit, you know, but for work like clinics like ours that resulted in the exoneration. So again, it was kind of student initiated, and then eventually it evolved into a full-fledged standalone clinic, which basically we operate like a standalone law firm. We evaluate the cases. We decide which cases to accept for legal representation, which cases to reject. And then we investigate the cases, litigate the cases, and then provide post-conviction reentry relief. So there's really three dimensions, three main pillars to the work of the EJC. We've been talking primarily about the client-focused work, the investigation litigation aspect of the work. And then we've talked briefly about the post-conviction reentry assistance work. But then on the front end, we also are engaged in legal reform. So we're looking to prevent wrongful conviction cases from happening in the first place because they're so difficult, great, you know, to litigate, to investigate, take years and years before you reach a successful outcome, if at all. So it would be better to prevent the wrongful conviction in the first place. So we've been working with the Indiana legislature to enact important legislation to do exactly that, substantially reduce the risk of wrongful convictions.
That's incredible. And you guys have obviously done amazing work. You're getting results of a clinic that's only been around for less than 6 years. My hat's off to you guys. Professor Grulet, is there a place if anybody wants to donate to help your clinic out where they can do that? We can put that in the description.
Well, they
can
go to the Exoneration Justice Clinic has a website on the Notre Dame Law School webpage. I don't know, Kevin, do you have the exact web address for that? We could
Yeah, it's exoneration.nd, as in Notre Dame, .edu. And there's a giving link somewhere on the website.
Great. And we'll put a link to that down the description too. Two other questions about the case before we wrap this up. I know Andrew's got another appointment coming up. One is there were two people identified in this murder on the basis of Brady that got Reggie released. Has there been any action taken by the state to actually go after the actual perpetrators?
You know, what I read in an article by the Indy Star last week is that the Elkhart PD said that they are looking into next steps. I don't know what that means. I can tell you from my experience, it's very rare that police departments go after the true killers in these cases because it's sort of an admission of error, right? Mm-hmm. It's acknowledging that you blew it the first time around. But the truth is, of course, they should be going after the true killers. And the family members, the living family members of the victim in the case, Chris Thomas, have said that they want the police department to go to try to apprehend the true killers. And I hope that happens because, you know, and Professor Grulet talks about this a lot, that the tragedy isn't just that someone was wrongfully incarcerated, but also that the two guys who did a murder have never faced any consequences for that, right? And have never been apprehended and have been free and, you know, free to, you know, at least conceivably continue engaging in that sort of conduct all these years. So I really hope that there is a meaningful effort to hold responsible the people who were involved in this murder.
Yeah, it's always the hope. And that's also been my experience, is it's so hard to get, you know, it's easier for the police department to say, oh, he was let off on they'll call it a technicality because it was a Brady violation. But, you know, the technicality here is that they got a pretty good idea who likely committed this murder. And so there's no justice for the victims. And then you always hate these cases when I've had them come up and then you start to investigate the people who are potentially the actual perpetrators and find out, oh, well, they killed two other people after that, you know, because they were left on the street. Yeah. So that's hopefully they do something with that. Hopefully they are actually taking next steps. The last question I want to ask, because I know, Andrew, this, you know, that brief was written, the Brady violation was included in that prior to your time. So Professor Grulet or Kevin, who found the Brady violation? I always want to know who found it.
Well, there were a lot of Brady violations, number one. And so, yeah, it was through discovery, you know, so that after we took the case and we then started filing requests for discovery, there was actually some depositions that were taken in some other wrongful conviction case that resulted in these new reports or these reports that had been withheld being discovered for the first time. And so it was maybe a little bit of luck on the one hand, but it was at the same time a very conscious, deliberate effort to find the truth. You know, this has been a search for the truth, nothing more. It's a search for the truth and a search for justice. And it's been a long time coming. You know, Andrew talked about, you know, being involved in the case, you know, a year and a half before the exoneration. I got involved in the case with a colleague of mine, Elliot Schlosser, I think back in as early as 2017, it was about 9 years before before he was Reggie was exonerated. So 9 years and counting is what it took to get to this result.
Well, it's an amazing effort. I want to thank you guys for all the work that you're doing. And again, thank you for joining us on the show. I mean, this has been just a riveting conversation. And with that, I'm going to let you guys go and move on to your next appointment. But I know you guys are busy, so I really appreciate the time. Andrew, good luck on the bar. I don't think you need it. I think you're a lock. And but gentlemen, then, thanks again.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Rob.
Appreciate your time. Appreciate it.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, the only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
It's tax season, and by now, we're all a bit tired of numbers. But here's an important one you need to hear. $16 billion. That's how much money in refunds the IRS flagged for possible identity fraud. But it's not all grim news. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. If your identity is stolen, they'll fix it. Guaranteed. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein-rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand-fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.